This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents 5 Feet Apart by Rachel Lippincott with Mickey Daughtry and Tobias Ikonas. Read by Corey Brill and Joy Osmansky.
Chapter 1. Stella. I trace the outline of my sister's drawing, lungs molded from a sea of flowers. Petals burst out from every edge of the twin ovals in soft pinks, deep whites, even heather blues, but somehow each one has a uniqueness, a vibrancy that feels like it'll bloom forever. Some of the flowers haven't blossomed yet, and I can feel the promise of life just waiting to unfold from the tiny buds under the weight of my finger. Those are my favorites. I wonder, all too often, what it would be like to have lungs this healthy, this alive. I take a deep breath, feeling the air fight its way in and out of my body. Slipping off the last petal of the last flower, my hand sinks, fingers dragging through the background of stars, each pinpoint of light that Abby drew a separate attempt to capture infinity. I clear my throat, pulling my hand away, and lean over to grab a picture of us from off my bed. Identical smiles peek out from underneath thick wool scarves, the holiday lights at the park down the street twinkling above our heads just like the stars in her drawing. There was something magical about it. The soft glow of the lampposts in the dark, the white snow clinging to the branches of the trees, the quiet stillness of it all. We nearly froze our butts off for that picture last year, but it was our tradition. Me and Abby, braving the cold to go see the holiday lights together. This photo always makes me remember that feeling. The feeling of going on an adventure with my sister. Just the two of us. The world expanding like an open book. I take a thumbtack and hang the picture next to the drawing before sitting down on my bed and grabbing my pocket notebook and pencil off my bedside table. My eyes travel down the long to-do list I made for myself this morning, starting with number 1, plan to-do list, which I've already put a satisfying line through, and going all the way down to number 22, contemplate the afterlife. Number 22 was probably just a little ambitious for a Friday afternoon, but at least for now I can cross off number 17, decorate walls. I look around the formerly stark room I've spent the better part of the morning making my own, once again. The walls now filled with the artwork Abby's given me through the years, bits of color and life jumping out from clinical white walls, each one a product of a different trip to the hospital. Me with an IV drip in my arm, the bag bursting with butterflies of different shapes and colors and sizes. Me wearing a nose cannula, the cable twisting to form an infinity sign. Me with my nebulizer, the vapor pouring out of it forming a cloudy halo. Then there's the most delicate one, a faded tornado of stars that she drew my very first time here. It's not as polished as her later stuff, but somehow that makes me like it more. And right underneath all that vibrancy is my pile of medical equipment, sitting right next to a hideous green faux leather hospital chair that comes standard for every room here at St. Grace's. I eye the empty IV pole warily, knowing my first of many rounds of antibiotics over the next month is exactly 1 hour and 9 minutes away. Lucky me. "Here it is," a voice calls from just outside my room. I look up as the door slowly creaks open and 2 familiar faces appear in the small crack of the doorway. Camila and Maya have visited me here 1 million times in the past decade, and they still can't get from the lobby to my room without asking every person in the building for directions. "Wrong room," I say, grinning as a look of pure relief washes over them. Maya laughs, pushing the door open the rest of the way. It honestly could have been. This place is still a freaking maze. Are you guys excited? I say, hopping up to give them both hugs. Camila pulls away to look at me, pouting, her dark brown hair practically drooping along with her. Second trip in a row without you. It's true. This isn't the first time my cystic fibrosis has taken me out of the running for some class trip or sunny vacation or school event. About 70% of the time, things are pretty normal for me. I go to school, I hang out with Camila and Maya, I work on my app. I just do it all with low-functioning lungs. But for the remaining 30% of my time, CF controls my life. Meaning, when I need to return to the hospital for a tune-up, I miss out on things like a class trip to the art museum or now our senior trip to Cabo. This particular tune-up just happens to be centered around the fact that I need to be pumped with antibiotics to finally get rid of a sore throat and a fever that won't go away. That, and my lung function is tanking. Maya plunks down on my bed, sighing dramatically as she lies back. It's only 2 weeks. Are you sure you can't come? It's our senior trip, Stella. I'm sure, I say firmly, and they know I mean it. We've been friends since middle school, and they know by now that when it comes to plans, my CF gets the final say. It's not like I don't want to go. It's just, quite literally, a matter of life or death. I can't go off to Cabo, or anywhere for that matter, and risk not coming back. I can't do that to my parents. Not now. You were the head of the planning committee this year, though. Can't you get them to move your treatments? We don't want you to be stuck here, Camila says, gesturing to the hospital room I so carefully decorated. I shake my head. We still have spring break together, and I haven't missed a spring break besties weekend since 8th grade when I got that cold, I say, smiling hopefully and looking back and forth between Camila and Maya. Neither of them returns my smile, though, and both opt to continue looking like I killed their family pets. I notice they're both holding the bags of bathing suits I told them to bring, so I grab Camila's out of her hand in a desperate attempt to change the subject. Oh, suit options! We have to pick out the best ones. Since I'm not going to be basking in the warm Cabo sun in a bathing suit of my choice, I figure I can at least live a little vicariously through my friends by picking out theirs with them. This perks them both up. We eagerly dump their bags out on my bed, creating a mishmash of florals and polka dots and fluorescents. I scan Camila's pile of bathing suits, grabbing a red one that falls somewhere between a bikini bottom and a single piece of thread, which I know, without a doubt, is a hand-me-down from her older sister Megan. I toss it to her. This one. It's very you. Her eyes widen, and she holds it up to her waist, fixing her wire-frame glasses in surprise. I mean, the tan lines would be pretty great. Camila, I say, grabbing a white and blue striped bikini that I can tell will fit her like a glove. I'm kidding. This one's perfect. She looks relieved, grabbing the bikini from me. I turn my attention to Maya's pile, but she's busy texting away from the green hospital chair in the corner, a big smile plastered on her face. I dig out a one-piece that she's had since swim class in 6th grade, holding it up to her with a smirk. How's this, Maya? Love it, looks great, she says, typing furiously. Camila snorts, putting her suits back in the bag and giving me a sly smile. Mason and Brooke called it quits, she says in explanation. Oh my God, they did not, I say. This is news. Amazing news. Well, not for Brooke. But Maya has been crushing on Mason since Mrs. Wilson's English class sophomore year, so this trip is her chance to finally make a move. It bums me out. I won't be there to help her make a killer 10-step whirlwind Cabo romance with Mason plan. Maya puts her phone away and shrugs casually, standing and pretending to look at some of the artwork on the walls. No big deal. We're going to meet him and Taylor at the airport tomorrow morning. I give her a look, and she breaks out into a huge smile. Okay, it's a little bit of a big deal. We all squeal with excitement, and I hold up an adorable polka dot one piece that is super vintage and right up her alley. She nods, grabbing it and holding it up to her body. I was totally hoping you'd pick this one. I look over to see Camila glancing at her watch nervously, which is no surprise. She's a champion procrastinator and probably hasn't packed a single thing for Cabo yet. Besides the bikini, of course. She sees me notice her checking her watch and grins sheepishly. I still need to buy a beach towel for tomorrow. Classic Camila. I stand up, my heart sinking in my chest at the thought of them leaving, but I don't want to hold them up. You guys have to get going then. Your plane is at, like, the ass crack of dawn tomorrow. Maya looks around the room sadly while Camila twists her bag of suits dejectedly around her hand. The two of them are making this even harder than I thought it would be. I swallow the guilt and annoyance that come bubbling up. It's not like they're the ones missing their senior trip to Cabo. At least they'll be together. I give them both big smiles, practically pulling them to the door with me. My cheeks hurt from all this fake positivity, but I don't want to ruin it for them. We'll send you a bunch of pictures, okay? Camila says, giving me a hug. You'd better. Photoshop me into a few, I say to Maya, who is a wizard at Adobe. You won't even know I wasn't there. They linger in the doorway, and I give them an exaggerated eye roll, playfully shoving them out into the hallway. Get out of here. Go have a great trip. Love you, Stella, they call as they walk down the hallway. I watch them go, waving until Maya's bouncing curls are completely out of sight, suddenly wanting nothing more than to be walking out with them, off to pack instead of unpack. My smile fades as I close the door and see the old family picture pinned carefully to the back of my door. It was taken a few summers ago on the front porch of our house during a 4th of July barbecue. Me, Abby, Mom, and Dad, goofy smiles on all our faces as the camera captures the moment. I feel a swell of homesickness as I hear the sound of the worn, rickety wood of that front step creaking underneath us as we laugh and get close for the picture. I miss that feeling. All of us together. Happy and healthy. For the most part. This isn't helping. Sighing, I pull myself away, looking over at the medicine cart. In all honesty, I like it here. It's been my home away from home since I was 6, so I usually don't mind coming. I get my treatments, I take my medicine, I drink my body weight in milkshakes, I get to see Barb and Julie, I leave until my next flare-up. Simple as that. But this time, I feel anxious, restless even. Because instead of just wanting to get healthy, I need to get healthy. For my parents' sake. Because they've gone and messed up everything by getting divorced. And after losing each other, they won't be able to handle losing me too. I know it. If I can get better, maybe... One step at a time. I head over to the wall oxygen, double-checking the flow meter is set properly, and listen for the steady hiss of the oxygen coming out of it before I pull the tube around my ears and slide the prongs of the cannula into my nose. Sighing, I sink down onto the familiarly uncomfortable hospital mattress and take a deep breath. I reach for my pocket notebook to read the next thing on my to-do list and keep myself preoccupied. Number 18. Record a video. I grab my pencil and bite it thoughtfully as I stare at the words I wrote earlier. Oddly enough, contemplating the afterlife seems easier right now. But the list is the list, so exhaling, I reach over to my bedside table to get my laptop, sitting cross-legged on the new floral comforter I picked out yesterday at Target while Camila and Maya were buying clothes for Cabo. I didn't even need the comforter, but they were so enthusiastic in helping me pick something out for my trip to the hospital, I felt bad not getting it. At least it sort of matches my walls now, bright and vibrant and colorful. I drum my fingers anxiously on the keyboard and squint at my reflection in the screen while my computer starts up. I frown at the mess of long brown hair and try to smooth it down, running my fingers through it over and over. Frustrated, I pull my hair tie off my wrist and resort to a messy bun in an attempt to look halfway decent for this video. I grab my copy of Java Coding for Android Phones off my bedside table and put my laptop on top of it, so I don't show some serious underchin and can have a shot that's remotely flattering. Logging onto my YouTube Live account, I adjust the webcam, making sure you can see Abby's lung drawing directly behind me. It's the perfect backdrop. I close my eyes and take a deep breath, hearing the familiar wheeze of my lungs trying desperately to fill with air through the sea of mucus. Exhaling slowly, I slap a big Hallmark greeting card smile on my face before opening my eyes and pressing the enter key to go live. Hey guys, is everyone having a good Black Friday? I waited for snow that never came. I glance into the corner of my screen as I turn the camera toward the hospital window, the sky a cloudy gray, the trees on the other side of the glass completely barren. I smile as my live stream count goes steadily past 1K, a fraction of the 23,940 YouTube subscribers who tune in to see how my battle with cystic fibrosis is going. So, I could be getting ready to go on a plane to Cabo for my school's senior trip, but instead, I'll be spending this holiday at my home away from home, thanks to a mild sore throat. Plus, a raging fever. I think back to when I got my temperature taken on intake this morning, the flashing numbers on the thermometer blaring out a strong 102. I don't want to mention it in the video, though, because my parents will definitely be watching this later. As far as they know, I just have a nagging cold. Who needs 2 whole weeks of sunshine and blue skies and beaches when you can have a month of luxury right in your own backyard? I rattle off the amenities, counting them on my fingers. Let's see. I've got a full-time concierge, unlimited chocolate pudding, and laundry service. Oh, and Barb talked Dr. Hamid into letting me keep all my meds and treatments in my room this time. Check it out. I turn the webcam to the pile of medical equipment and then to the medicine cart next to me, which I've already perfectly organized into alphabetical and chronological order by the scheduled dosage time I plugged into the app I made. It's finally ready for a test run. That was number 14 on today's to-do list, and I'm pretty proud of how it turned out. My computer dings as comments begin rolling in. I see one mentioning Barb's name with some heart emojis. She's a crowd favorite just as much as she's my favorite. Ever since I first came to the hospital more than 10 years ago, she's been the respiratory therapist here, slipping candy to me and the other CFers, like my partner in crime, Poe. She holds our hand through even the most bone-crushing grips of pain like it's nothing. I've been making YouTube videos for about half that time to raise awareness about cystic fibrosis. Through the years, more people than I could have ever imagined began following my surgeries and my treatments and my visits to St. Grace's, sticking with me through my awkward braces phase and everything. My lung function is down to 35%. I say as I turn the camera back to me. Dr. Hamid says I'm steadily climbing to the top of the transplant list now, so I'll be here for a month, taking antibiotics, sticking to my regimen. My eyes travel to the drawing behind me, the healthy lungs looming over my head, just out of reach. I shake my head and smile, leaning over to grab a bottle from the medicine cart. That means taking my medications on time, wearing my Aflo vest to break up that mucus, and, I hold up the bottle, a whole lot of this liquid nutrition through my G-tube every night. If any ladies out there are wishing they could eat 5,000 calories a day and still have a Cabo-ready beach body, I'm up for a trade. My computer dings away, messages pouring in one after another. Reading a few, I let the positivity push away all the negativity I felt going into this. Hang in there, Stella. We love you. Marry me. New lungs can come in at any moment, so I've got to be ready. I say the words like I believe them wholeheartedly. Though after all these years, I've learned to not get my hopes up too much. Ding, another message. I've got CF, and you remind me to always stay positive. XOXO. My heart warms, and I give a final big smile for the camera, for that person fighting the same fight that I am. This time it's genuine. All right, guys. Thanks for watching. Gotta double-check my afternoon and evening meds now. You know how anal I am. I hope everyone has a great week. Bye. I end the live video and exhale slowly, closing the browser to see the smiling, winter formal ready faces on my desktop background. Me, Camila, and Maya, arm in arm, all in the same deep red lipstick we'd picked out together at Sephora. Camila had wanted a bright pink, but Maya had convinced us that red was the color we needed in our life. I'm still not convinced that was true. Lying back, I pick up the worn panda resting on my pillow and wrap my arms tightly around him. Patches, my sister Abby named him. And what a fitting name that became. The years of coming in and out of the hospital with me have certainly taken their toll on him. Multicolored patches are sewn over spots where he ripped open, his stuffing pouring out when I squeezed too hard during the most painful of my treatments. There's a knock on my door, and it flies open not even a second later as Barb bursts in, holding an armful of pudding cups for me to take my medicine with. I'm back, delivery. When it comes to Barb, not much has changed in the past 6 months, or the past 10 years for that matter. She's still the best. The same short, curly hair, the same colorful scrubs, the same smile that lights up the entire room. But then, an extremely pregnant Julie trails behind her, carrying an IV drip. Now, that's a big change from 6 months ago. I swallow my surprise and grin at Barb as she places the pudding at the edge of my bed for me to sort onto my medicine cart, then pulls out a list to double-check that the cart has everything I need on it. "What would I do without you?" I ask. She winks. "You'd die." Julie hangs the IV bag of antibiotics next to me, her belly brushing up against my arm. Why didn't she tell me she's pregnant? I go rigid, smiling thinly as I eye her baby bump and try to subtly move away from it. A lot's changed in the past 6 months. She rubs her belly, blue eyes shining brightly as she gives me a big smile. You want to feel her kick? No, I say, a little too quickly. I feel bad when she looks slightly taken aback at my bluntness, her blonde eyebrows arching up in surprise. But I don't want any of my bad juju near that perfect, healthy baby. Luckily, her eyes travel to my desktop background. Are those your winter formal pics? I saw a bunch on Insta, she says, excited. How was it? Super fun, I say, with a ton of enthusiasm as the awkwardness melts away. I open up a folder on my desktop filled with pictures. Crushed it on the dance floor for a solid 3 songs. Got to ride in a limo. The food didn't suck. Plus, I made it to 10:30 before I got tired, which was way better than expected. Who needs a curfew when your body does it for you, right? I show her and Barb some pictures we all took at Maya's house before the dance while she hooks me up to the IV drip and tests my blood pressure and O2 reading. I remember I used to be afraid of needles, but with every blood draw and IV drip, that fear slowly drifted away. Now, I don't even flinch. It makes me feel strong every time I get poked or prodded, like I can overcome anything. Alrighty, Barb says when they get all my vitals and finish ooing and aahing over my sparkly silver A-line gown and my white rose corsage. Camila, Maya, and I decided to swap corsages when we went stag to the formal. I didn't want to take a date, not that anybody asked me anyway. It was super possible that I would need to bail the day of or wouldn't feel well halfway through the dance, which wouldn't have been fair to whomever I could have gone with. The two of them didn't want me to feel left out, so instead of getting dates of their own, they decided we'd all go together. Because of the Mason developments, though, that doesn't seem super likely for prom. Barb nods to the filled medicine cart, resting a hand on her hip. I'll still monitor you, but you're pretty much good to go. She holds up a pill bottle. Remember, you have to take this one with food, she says, putting it carefully back and holding up another one. And make sure you don't... I got it, Barb, I say. She's just being her usual motherly self, but she holds up her hands in surrender. Deep down, she knows that I'll be absolutely fine. I wave goodbye as they both head toward the door, using the remote next to my bed to sit it up a little more. By the way, Barb says slowly as Julie ducks out of the room. Her eyes narrow at me and she gives me a gentle warning look. I want you to finish your IV drip first, but Pose just checked into room 310. What? Really? I say, my eyes widening as I move to launch myself out of bed to find him. I can't believe he didn't tell me he'd be here. Barb steps forward, grabbing my shoulders and pushing me gently back down onto the bed before I can fully stand. What part of I want you to finish your IV drip first did you not get? I smile sheepishly at her, but how could she blame me? Poe was the first friend I made when I came to the hospital. He's the only one who really gets it. We've fought CF together for a freaking decade. Well, together from a safe distance, anyway. We can't get too close to each other. For cystic fibrosis patients, cross-infection from certain bacteria strains is a huge risk. One touch between two CFers can literally kill the both of them. Her serious frown gives way to a gentle smile. Settle in. Relax. Take a chill pill. She eyes the medicine cart, jokingly. Not literally. I nod, a real laugh spilling out as a fresh wave of relief fills me at the news of Poe being here, too. I'll stop by later to help you with your offlo vest, Barb says over her shoulder as she leaves. Grabbing my phone, I settle for a quick text message instead of a mad dash down the hall to room 310. You're here? Me too. Tune up. Not even a second goes by, and my screen lights up with his reply. Bronchitis. Just happened. I'll live. Come by and wave at me later. Gonna crash now. I lean back on the bed, exhaling long and slow. Truth is, I'm nervous about this visit. My lung function fell to 35% so quickly, and now, even more than the fever and the sore throat, being here in the hospital for the next month doing treatment after treatment to stem the tide while my friends are far away is freaking me out. A lot. 35% is a number that keeps my mom up at night. She doesn't say it, but her computer does. Search after search about lung transplants and lung function percentages, new combinations and phrasing, but always the same idea. How to get me more time. It makes me more afraid than I've ever been before. But not for me. When you have CF, you sort of get used to the idea of dying young. No, I'm terrified for my parents, and what will become of them if the worst does happen, now that they don't have each other. But with Poe here, someone who understands, I can get through it. Once I'm actually allowed to see him. The rest of the afternoon goes by slowly. I work on my app, double-checking that I worked out the programming error that kept coming up when I tried to run it on my phone. I put some Fusidin on the sore skin around my G-tube in an attempt to make it less fire engine red and more of a summer sunset pink. I check and double-check my at-bedtime pile of bottles and pills. I reply to my parents every hour on the hour texts. I gaze out the window as the afternoon fades and see a couple about my age, laughing and kissing as they walk into the hospital. It's not every day you see a happy couple coming into a hospital. Watching them holding hands and exchanging longing glances, I wonder what it would be like to have somebody look at me like that. People are always looking at my cannula, my scars, my G-tube, not at me. It doesn't make guys want to line up by my locker. I dated Tyler Paul my freshman year of high school, but that lasted all of a month until I came down with an infection and needed to go to the hospital for a few weeks. Even just a few days in, his texts started to get further and further apart, and I decided to break up with him. Besides, it was nothing like that couple out in the courtyard. Tyler's palms were sweaty when we held hands, and he wore so much Axe body spray, I would go into coughing fits every time we hugged. This thought process is not exactly a helpful distraction, so I even give number 22, Contemplate the Afterlife, on my to-do list to try, and read some of Life, Death, and Immortality, The Journey of the Soul. But pretty soon, I opt to just lie on my bed, looking up at the ceiling and listening to the wheezing sound of my breathing. I can hear the air struggling to get past the mucus that takes up space in my lungs. Rolling over, I crack open a vial of Flovent to give my lungs a helping hand. I pour the liquid into a nebulizer by my bed, the small machine humming to life as vapors pour from the mouthpiece. I sit, staring at the drawing of the lungs while I breathe in and out, and in and out, and in and out. I hope when my parents come to visit over the next few days, my breathing is a little less labored. I told them both that the other one was taking me to the hospital this morning, but I actually just took an Uber here from the corner a street over from my mom's new place. I don't want either of them to have to face seeing me here again, at least until I'm looking better. My mom was already giving me troubled looks when I needed to put my portable oxygen on just to pack. There's a knock on my door, and I look over from the wall I'm staring at, hoping it's Poe stopping by to wave at me. I pull the mouthpiece off as Barb pops her head in. She drops a surgical face mask and latex gloves onto a table next to my door. New one upstairs. Meet me in 15? My heart leaps. I nod, and she gives me a big smile before ducking out of the room. I grab the mouthpiece and take one more quick hit of the Flovent, letting the vapor fill my lungs the best I can before I'm up and moving. Shutting the nebulizer off, I pick up my portable oxygen concentrator from where it's been charging next to my bed, press the circular button in the center to turn it on, and pull the strap over my shoulder. After I put the cannula in, I head over to the door, pulling on the blue latex gloves and wrapping the strings of the face mask around my ears. Sliding into my white Converse, I push my door open and squeeze out into the whitewashed corridor, deciding to go the long way so I can walk past Poe's room. I pass the nurse's station in the center of the floor, waving hello to a young nurse's assistant named Sarah, who is smiling over the top of the new, sleek metal cubicle. They replaced that before my last visit 6 months ago. It's the same height, but it used to be made of this worn wood that had probably been around since the hospital was founded 60-some years ago. I remember when I was small enough to sneak past to whatever room Poe was in, my head still a good few inches from clearing the desk. Now, it comes up to my elbow. Heading down the hallway, I grin as I see a small Colombian flag taped on the outside of a half-open door, an overturned skateboard keeping it propped slightly open. I peer inside to see Poe fast asleep on his bed, curled into a surprisingly tiny ball underneath his plaid comforter, a suave Gordon Ramsay poster positioned directly over his bed, keeping watch over him. I draw a heart on the dry erase board he's stuck to the outside of his door to let him know I've been there, before moving off down the hallway toward the wooden double doors that will take me to the main part of the hospital, up an elevator, down C-Wing, across the bridge into Building 2, and straight to the neonatal intensive care unit. One of the perks of coming here for more than a decade is that I know the hospital just as well as I knew the house I grew up in. Every winding corridor or hidden staircase or secret shortcut explored over and over again. But before I can open the double doors, a room door swings open next to me, and I turn my head in surprise to see the profile of a tall, thin boy I've never seen before. He's standing in the doorway of room 315, holding a sketchbook in one hand and a charcoal pencil in the other, a white hospital bracelet like mine wrapped around his wrist. I stop dead. His tousled, dark chocolate brown hair is perfectly unruly, like he just popped out of a teen Vogue and landed smack in the middle of St. Grace's Hospital. His eyes are a deep blue, the corners crinkling as he talks. But it's his smile that catches my eye more than anything else. It's lopsided and charming, and it has a magnetic warmth to it. He's so cute, my lung function feels like it dropped another 10%. It's a good thing this mask is covering half my face, because I did not plan for cute guys on my floor this hospital stay. "I've clocked their schedules," he says as he puts the pencil casually behind his ear. I shift slightly to the left and see that he's grinning at the couple I saw coming into the hospital earlier. "So, unless you plant your ass on the call button, no one's gonna bother you for at least an hour. And don't forget, I gotta sleep in that bed, dude." "Way ahead of you." I watch as the girl unzips the duffel bag she's holding to show him blankets. "Wait, what?" Cute guy whistles. "Look at that, a regular Girl Scout." "We're not animals, man," her boyfriend says to him, giving him a big dude-to-dude smile.
"Oh my God, gross. He's letting his friends do it in his room like it's a motel."
I grimace and resume walking down the hallway to the exit doors, putting as much space as possible between me and whatever scheme is going on in there. So much for cute.
Chapter 2. Will. "All right, I'll see you guys later," I say, winking at Jason and closing the door to my room to give them some privacy. I come face to face with the empty sockets of the skull drawing on my door, an O2 mask slung over its mouth with the words, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here," written under it. That should have been the slogan for this hospital, or any of the other 50 I've been in for the past 8 months of my life. I squint down the hallway to see the door swinging shut behind the girl I saw moving into a room down the hall earlier today, her scuffed white Converse disappearing onto the other side. She'd been by herself, lugging a duffel bag big enough for about 3 fully grown adults, but she actually looked kind of hot. And, let's be honest here, it's not every day you see a remotely attractive girl hanging around a hospital, no more than 5 doors down from yours. Looking down at my sketchbook, I shrug, rolling it up and stuffing it into my back pocket before heading down the hallway after her. It's not like I have anything better to do, and I'm certainly not trying to stick around here for the next hour. Pushing through the doors, I see her making her way across the gray tile floor, waving and chatting to just about everyone as she goes, like she's putting on her own personal Thanksgiving Day parade. She steps onto the large glass elevator, overlooking the east lobby, just past a large, decked-out Christmas tree they must have put up early this morning, long before the Thanksgiving leftovers were even eaten. Heaven forbid they leave up the giant turkey display for even a minute longer. I watch as her hands reach up to fix her face mask, while she leans over to press a button, the doors slowly closing. I start climbing the open stairs by the elevator, trying not to run into anyone as I watch it chug steadily to the fifth floor, of course. I run up the stairs as fast as my lungs will carry me, managing to get to the fifth floor with enough time to go into a serious coughing fit and recover before she exits the elevator and disappears around a corner. I rub my chest, clearing my throat and following her down a couple of hallways and onto the wide, glass-encased bridge leading to the next building. Even though she just got here this morning, she clearly knows where she's going. Judging from her pace and the fact she apparently knows every single person in the building, I wouldn't be surprised if she were actually the mayor of this place. I've been here 2 weeks, and it took me until yesterday to figure out how to sneak safely from my room to the cafeteria over in Building 2, and I am by no means directionally challenged. I've been in so many hospitals over the years, figuring out how to get around them is what counts as a hobby to me now. She stops short under a set of double doors reading East Entrance, Neonatal Intensive Care Unit, and peeks inside before she pushes them open. The NICU. Odd. Having kids when you have CF falls into the super difficult category. I've heard of girls with CF bumming hard over it, but going to stare at babies she might never have is a whole other level. That's just fucking depressing. There are a lot of things that piss me off about CF, but that's not one of them. Pretty much all guys with CF are infertile, which at least means I don't have to worry about getting anyone pregnant and starting my own shit show of a family. Bet Jason wishes he had that going for him right now. Looking both ways, I close the gap between me and the doors, peering inside the narrow window to see her standing in front of the viewing pane, her eyes focused on a small baby inside an incubator on the other side. Its fragile arms and legs are hooked up to machines 10 times its size. Pushing open the door and sliding inside the dimly lit hallway, I smile as I watch Converse Girl for a second. I can't help but stare at her reflection, everything beyond the glass blurring as I look at her. She's prettier close up, with her long eyelashes and her full eyebrows. She even makes a face mask look good. I watch as she brushes her wavy, sandy brown hair out of her eyes, staring at the baby through the glass with a determined focus. I clear my throat, getting her attention. And here I thought this was going to be another lame hospital filled with lame sickies, but then you show up. Lucky me. Her eyes meet mine in the reflection of the glass, surprise filling them at first, and then almost immediately changing to something resembling disgust. She looks away, back at the baby, staying silent. Well, that's a promising sign. Nothing like actual repulsion to start off on the right foot. I saw you moving into your room. Gonna be here a while? She doesn't say anything. If it wasn't for the grimace, I'd think she didn't even hear me. Oh, I get it. I'm so good-looking you can't even string a sentence together. That annoys her enough to get a response. Shouldn't you be procuring rooms for your guests? She snaps, turning to face me as she angrily pulls her face mask off. She takes me off guard for a second, and I laugh, surprised by how upfront she is. That really pisses her off. You rent by the hour, or what? She asks, her dark eyes narrowing. Ha! It was you lurking in the hall. I don't lurk, she fires back. You followed me here. It's a valid point. But she definitely lurked first. I pretend to be taken aback and hold up my hands in mock defeat. With the intent of introducing myself, but with that attitude. Let me guess, she says, cutting me off. You consider yourself a rebel, ignoring the rules because it somehow makes you feel in control. Am I right? You're not wrong, I shoot back before leaning against the wall casually. You think it's cute? I grin at her. I mean, you must think it's pretty adorable. You stood in the hallway an awfully long time staring. She rolls her eyes, clearly not entertained by me. You letting your friends borrow your room for sex isn't cute. Ah, so she's a real goody two-shoes. Sex? Oh, heavens no. They told me they would be holding a slightly rowdy book club meeting in there for the better part of an hour. She glares at me, definitely not amused by my sarcasm. Ah, so that's what this is about, I say, crossing my arms over my chest. You have something against sex.
Of course not. I've had sex, she says, her eyes widening as the words tumble out of her mouth. It's fine.
That's the biggest lie I've heard all year, and I'm practically surrounded by people who sugarcoat the fact I'm dying. I laugh. Fine isn't exactly a ringing endorsement, but I'll take common ground where I can get it. Her thick eyebrows form a frown. We have nothing in common. I wink, having way too much fun pissing her off. Cold. I like it. The door bangs open, and Barb bursts through, making both of us jump in surprise at the sudden noise.
Will Newman, what are you doing up here? You're not supposed to leave the third floor after that stunt you pulled last week.
I look back at the girl. There you go. A name to go with your little psych profile. And you are... She glowers at me, quickly pulling her face mask back over her mouth before Barb notices.
Ignoring you.
Good one. Miss Goody Two-Shoes has some spunk.
And clearly the teacher's pet, too. 6 feet at all times. You both know the rules.
I realize I'm too close and take a step back as Barb reaches us, coming into the space and the tension between us. She turns to look at me, her eyes narrowing.
What do you think you're doing up here?
I say, pointing at the viewing window. Looking at babies? She's clearly not amused.
Get back to your room. Where is your face mask?
I reach up to touch my maskless face.
Stella, thank you for keeping your mask on.
She didn't 5 seconds ago, I mutter. Stella glares at me over Barb's head, and I give her back a big smile.
Stella. Her name is Stella.
I can see Barb's about to really ream me out, so I decide to make my exit. I've had more than enough lecturing for the moment. Lighten up, Stella, I say, sauntering to the door. It's just life. It'll be over before we know it. I head out through the doors, across the bridge, and down C Wing. Instead of going back the long way, I hop on a much shakier, non-glass elevator, which I discovered 2 days ago. It spits me out right by the nurse's station on my floor, where Julie is reading over some paperwork. Hey, Julie, I say, leaning on the counter and picking up a pencil. She glances up at me, giving me a quick look before her eyes swing back down to the papers in her hands. Just what were you up to?
Roaming the hospital, pissing off Barb, I say, shrugging and twirling the pencil around and around in my fingertips. She's such a hard ass.
Will, she's not a hard ass, she's just, you know. I give her a look.
A hard ass?
She leans against the nurse's station, putting a hand on her super pregnant belly.
Firm. The rules matter, especially to Barb. She doesn't take chances.
I glance over to see the doors at the end of the hallway swing wide open again as Barb and the goody-goody herself step out. Barb's eyes narrow at me, and I shrug innocently.
What? I'm talking to Julie.
She huffs, and the two of them walk off down the hallway towards Stella's room. Stella fixes her face mask, looking back at me, her eyes meeting mine for a fraction of a second. I sigh, watching her go.
She hates me.
Which one? Julie asks, following my gaze down the hallway. The door to Stella's room closes behind the both of them, and I look back at Julie. She gives me a look that I've seen about a million times since I got here. Her blue eyes fill with a mix between, are you crazy, and something very close to care. Mostly, are you crazy, though?
Don't even think about it, Will. I glance down at the file sitting in front of her, the name jumping out at me from the upper left-hand corner. Stella Grant.
Okay,
I say, like it's no big deal. Night. I stroll back to 315, coughing when I get there, the mucus thick in my lungs and throat, my chest aching from my excursion. If I had known I was going to be running a half marathon all around the hospital, I might have bothered to bring my portable oxygen. Who am I kidding? I check my watch to make sure it's been an hour before pushing open the door. I flick on the light, noticing a folded note from Hope and Jason on the bleach-white standard-issue hospital sheets. How romantic of them. I try not to be disappointed they're already gone. My mom pulled me out of school and switched me to homeschooling with a side of international hospital tourism when I got diagnosed with bisepatia 8 months ago. As if my lifespan wasn't already going to be ridiculously short, bisepatia will cut off another huge chunk of it by making my shitty lung function deplete even faster than it already has. And they don't give you new lungs when you have an antibiotic-resistant bacteria running rampant inside of you. But incurable is only a suggestion to my mother, and she's determined to find the needle-in-a-haystack treatment, even if it means cutting me off from everyone. At least this hospital is half an hour away from Hope and Jason, so they can come visit me on a regular basis and fill me in on everything I'm missing at school. Since I got bisepatia, I feel like they're the only ones in my life who don't treat me like a lab rat. They've always been that way. Maybe that's why they're so perfect for each other. I unfold the note to see a heart and, in Hope's neat cursive, "See you soon. 2 weeks till you're big 18. Hope and Jason." And that makes me smile. Big 18. 2 more weeks until I'm in charge. I'll be off this latest clinical drug trial and out of this hospital, and I can do something with my life instead of letting my mom waste it. No more hospitals. No more being stuck inside whitewashed buildings all over the world as doctors try drug after drug, treatment after treatment, none of them working. If I'm going to die, I'd like to actually live first. And then I'll die. I squint at the heart, thinking about that fateful last day. Somewhere poetic. A beach, maybe. Or a rowboat somewhere in Mississippi. Just no walls. I could sketch the landscape, draw a final cartoon of me giving the middle finger to the universe, then bite the big one. I toss the note back onto the bed, eyeing the sheets before giving them a quick whiff to be safe. Starch and bleach. Just the regular hospital eau de cologne. Good. I slide into the squeaky leather hospital recliner by the window and push aside a heap of colored pencils and sketchbooks, grabbing my laptop from under a bunch of photocopied 1940s political cartoons I was looking at earlier for reference. I open my browser and type Stella Grant into Google, not expecting much. She seems like the type to only have the most private of Facebook pages, or a lame Twitter account where she retweets memes about the importance of hand-washing. The first result, though, is a YouTube page called Stella Grant's Not-So-Secret CF Diary, filled with at least 100 videos dating back 6 years or so. I squint because the page looks weirdly familiar. Oh my God, this is that lame channel my mom sent me a link to a few months ago in an attempt to rally me into taking my treatment seriously. Maybe if I'd known she looked like that. I scroll down to the first entry, clicking on a video with a thumbnail of a young Stella wearing a mouthful of metal and a high ponytail. I try not to laugh. I wonder what her teeth look like now, considering I've never seen her smile. Probably pretty nice. She seems like the type who would actually wear her retainer at night instead of letting it collect dust on some bathroom shelf. I don't think mine even made it home from the orthodontist. I hit the volume button, and her voice comes pouring out of my speakers. Like all CFers, I was born terminal. Our bodies make too much mucus, and that mucus likes to get into our lungs and cause infections, making our lung function deteriorate. The young girl stumbles over the big word before flashing the camera a big smile. Right now, I'm at 50% lung function. There's a crappy cut, and she turns around on a set of stairs that I recognize from the main entrance of the hospital. No wonder she knows her way around here so well. She's been coming here forever. I smile back at the little girl, even though that cut was the cheesiest thing I've ever seen. She sits down on the steps, taking a deep breath. Dr. Hamid says, at this rate, I'm gonna need a transplant by the time I'm in high school. A transplant's not a cure, but it will give me more time. I'd love a few more years if I'm lucky enough to get one. Tell me about it, Stella. At least she's got a shot.
Chapter 3. Stella. I pull on the blue afflo vest, snapping it into place around my torso with Barb's help. It looks an awful lot like a life vest, except for the remote coming out of it. For the quickest moment, I let it be a life vest, and I stare out the window, picturing myself in Cabo on a boat with Maya and Camila, the afternoon sun glowing on the horizon. The seagulls chirping, the sandy beach in the distance, the shirtless surfers. And then, despite myself, I think of Will. I blink, Cabo fading away as the barren trees outside my window swing into view. So, Will, he's a CFer then? I ask, though that's obvious. Barb helps me clip the last strap into place. I pull at the shoulder of the vest so it doesn't rub into my bony collarbone. A CFer and then some. B. Sapatia. He's part of the new drug trial for sevoflomalin. She reaches over, flicking the machine on and giving me a look. My eyes widen and I look over at my giant tub of hand sanitizer. I was that close to him and he has B. Sapatia? It's pretty much a death sentence for people with CF. He'll be lucky to make it a few more years. And that's if he's as dedicated to his regimen as I am. The vest begins vibrating, hard. I can feel the mucus in my lungs starting to slowly loosen. You contract that and you can kiss the possibility of new lungs goodbye, she adds, eyeing me. Stay away. I nod. Oh, I fully intend to do just that. I need that extra time. Besides, he was way too full of himself to be my type. The trial, I start to say, looking over at Barb and holding up my hand to pause the conversation as I cough up a wad of mucus. She nods in approval and hands me a standard-issue pale pink bedpan. I spit into it and wipe my mouth before talking. What are his odds? Barb exhales, shaking her head before meeting my gaze. Nobody knows. The drug's too new. Her look says it all, though. We fall silent except for the chugging of the machine, the vest vibrating away. You're set. Need anything before I hit the road? I grin at her, giving her a pleading look. A milkshake? She rolls her eyes, putting her hands on her hips. What, am I room service now? Gotta take advantage of the perks, Barb, I say, which makes her laugh. She leaves and I sit back, the afflo vest making my whole body shake as it works. My mind wanders and I picture Will's reflection in the glass of the NICU, standing just behind me with a daring smile on his face. B. Sapatia. That's rough. But walking around the hospital without a mask on? It's no wonder he got it in the first place, pulling stunts like that. I've seen his type in the hospital more times than I can count. The careless, braveheart type, rebelling in a desperate attempt to defy their diagnosis before it all comes to an end. It's not even original. All right. Barb says, bringing me not one, but two milkshakes, like the queen she is. This should hold you over for a bit. She puts them on the table next to me, and I smile up at her familiar dark brown eyes. Thanks, Barb. She nods, touching my head gently before heading out the door. Night, baby. See you tomorrow. I sit, staring out the window and coughing up more and more mucus as the vest does its job to clear my airways. My eyes travel to the drawing of the lungs and the picture hanging next to it. My chest starts to hurt in a way that has